Love is the unselfish interest in the well-being of another.
G'day gang, welcome to the Hidden Why podcast. This is episode 389. It's a replay interview I did with Dana Lamon some time ago. I thought I'd replay it because I really enjoyed it and I thought there was a lot of value in it. So I'm bringing it back to you today whilst I continue editing my book and working on this project that is keeping me quite busy. Guys, I hope this brings some value to you. If you love it, please share it with your friends, share it with your family, share the love. I appreciate that. Help spread the message further. And if you'd like to connect with me, you can do so at thehiddenwhy.com. You can connect with me on Twitter, or even better, Facebook, or even better, thehiddenwhyguy@gmail.com. Guys, I'd love to hear from you. So if you have any questions, thoughts, or feedback for the show, please reach out to me and let's connect. So that's it from me, guys. Enjoy this show. Hope it brings some value to your day. Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Hidden Why podcast. Today I am pumped and excited. I've got a fantastic guest joining me tonight. His name is Dana Lamon. How are you, Dana?
Oh, I'm doing well, Lee. How are you?
I'm fantastic, and you're coming through nice and clear right now, so that's good news for everyone listening. So, Dana, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for coming on the show. I'm so grateful for you to be here, and having read about you and some of the advice you gave in a recent Toastmasters magazine, I just had to connect with you. Now, for those people that are familiar with Toastmasters, you are actually the international champion, world champion of the public speaking in 1992. Is that correct?
1992. It was a long time ago. Yes.
Going back a few years, you must have been pretty fresh, because in the pre-interview you said you've been, about 28 years in the Toastmasters club.
Yes, I joined Toastmasters in 1988, and the following year I went to a district conference and witnessed the International Speech Contest, and I decided I wanted to be in it. So 1990, I did my first competition and came in third place at the district level, so I didn't get to the world championship. 1991,
still a huge effort.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 91, I actually made it to the world championship and came in second place. I had planned to stop there, but some fellow Toastmasters said, why don't you try it again and go for first place? So I did it again in 1992, and that's when I won the world championship.
Fantastic. How did that feel?
It was a feeling that I have not been able to find the appropriate words. As best I can say, when I heard my name announced as the world champion, I heard the name, and as I tell people, the next thing I knew, I was standing on the stage to receive the trophy. I don't recall walking to the stage. So I guess that's the feeling that people have when they talk about walking on clouds.
Wow.
I did not feel the floor underneath my feet. I mean, it was quite exciting.
So that's a huge feat in such a short time with the club. Is motivational speaking something you did before Toastmasters? I mean, what's your history of getting into it? Because I'm a Toastmaster myself, as I said, and I recently just departed from a Southport Toastmasters club in Australia. Fantastic club. And I really enjoyed it. And I actually went in there to overcome my fear of public speaking, which maybe a lot of people wouldn't realize. But what was your reason for entering Toastmasters back then?
The initial motivation was to learn to put humor in my speeches. Prior to then, I had invitations to speak in churches and in schools. Primarily, I guess, because of my blindness and what I had accomplished, notwithstanding my blindness, I got invitations to go to schools and speak to children, and I was active in church. I got invitations to go to church. But I had a friend who asked me to give a humorous speech at his wedding.
Okay.
And that's where I found myself at a challenge, almost a roadblock. I lost sleep for two nights trying to figure out what to say at a wedding that would be funny. And after I did that event, my wife at the time suggested that I join Toastmasters. I had not heard of them before, but I looked in the calendar section of the newspaper that very day, and there was a meeting that night. So I went to Toastmasters that evening.
So you just took action. Now, there's a fair bit to unpack in all of that. But what's your background? You've got a background in law, is that correct?
Yes, I graduated from Yale University with a degree in math and decided to go to law school. So I attended law school at the University of Southern California. I worked, I became a member of the California Bar in 1978. And in 1981, I started working as a judge, and that's what I retired from. I worked 29 years as an administrative judge for the California Department of Social Services. So I didn't do typical courtroom stuff. I did administrative stuff, applying the laws that affect social services programs.
Okay. So it was during that time you were sort of asked to speak at schools and churches and different community events?
Correct.
Okay, great. Yeah. So you had some experience there, and I guess you must have had passion for public speaking. Is that right? Like you just enjoy motivating and inspiring people to get more fulfillment in life?
I inherited from my mother the love of talking, and it was the skills of public speaking that I acquired through Toastmasters. I had a teacher in high school who convinced me to join the speech club at the high school. So that's when I, outside of church, up to then, 10th grade in high school, I was speaking only in churches.
Okay.
Well, more specifically, only in my church.
Yeah.
And then the English teacher in high school convinced me to join the speech club. And that's when I started speaking outside. But when I left high school, that was the end of it until law school required arguments in moot court. I didn't do much. And in the late 70s is when I started being invited more to other churches in addition to going to schools.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, your history, you were, I don't know how to pronounce it, but you were predicted blind at the age of 4. Is that right? Or was there some tragedy?
Yes. At age 4, I fell on my head. I was running backwards and I fell on the back of my head. It caused an injury to the head, which was what concerned the doctors initially. But my mother discovered that something else was wrong because I started bumping into furniture and bumping into the walls at the house. And I was taken back to the hospital, and that's when examination showed that I had retina detachments in both my eyes. Surgery repaired the right eye, so I was able to see well enough, starting off to read regular print. And then over time, I gradually lost the sight in that right eye. Never restored sight to the left eye. So the right eye I could see out of starting at age about 6 years old. And over from 6 to 24 is when I, the time period over which I again, lost the sight in the right eye.
Wow, okay. So did you have sort of clear vision through that right eye, or was it always a bit sort of hazy?
No, it was pretty clear. It was pretty clear, yeah. The retina, what actually happened over that 18-year period of time is that the retina became detached again.
Ah, okay.
And that's where the problem was. So I saw colors until I was 16 years old. So. Yeah. And then I saw light until I was 24 years old.
Okay. It seems like a very freakish sort of incident to happen at the age of 4, very young age.
Yeah. But you know, the advantage to it being at age 4, you don't know enough about what the world is supposed to be anyway. So it doesn't, you know,
probably in doesn't affect you as largely. Yeah, if you lost it at the age of 30.
Right. In some respects, you know, I was thinking everybody goes through this at some point.
Yeah. No, very true. Well, look, I think it's amazing. And just on that, you said you like to talk. Now, as someone who likes to talk, do you like to listen as well? And I can only assume that with that condition, being blind, that you would have to listen quite well. But yeah, what's your take on that?
I do like to listen, and in fact, the job that I had, as I mentioned, as an administrative judge,
that was
my job. Listen, listen carefully to what the people said and what their concerns were, and apply the laws and regulations based on what they said. Toastmasters made me a better listener because I learned to organize what people say. If they don't create a structure for what they say, then I mentally create the structure so that it would be easier for me to remember what was said.
Okay. So you learn a lot of skills, obviously, at Toastmasters, and again, one of them being listening as well. What's your interpretation on the importance of listening? Because we always hear it often enough, you know, you have to be a good listener, and it's more important to listen to build relationships rather than just always talk. But what's your breakdown on that? Where's the balance?
And you've pointed out, I think, the important situation there, and that is it's all about the relationships.
Hmm.
And I don't know who you are. You are the collection of your thoughts and your emotions.
Yeah.
And so I don't fully know who you are until I listen to you. I listen to you share your thoughts and share your emotions, share your ideas, and then I begin to understand who you are.
Hmm.
When I know who you are, then I know what kind of relationship I can establish with you.
Yeah. Very good point. There's a saying, and it comes from a book. I think it, excuse me, might be one of Don Miguel Ruiz. He's got a book called The Four Agreements. And I think one of the principles is seek first to understand and then be understood. Or am I thinking of another book? It might be The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. But it goes very importantly as far as, you know, listening and trying to understand someone before you can actually then be understood by them in that relationship, I guess.
I think that's very important, and I can't help you out. I read both of those books, but I read them more than 10 years ago, so I can't remember.
Yeah.
But it is... You know, very often, as I said, I like to talk, and I found myself, or I many times would find myself after, let's say, I get off the telephone, I would ask myself, Dana, did you talk too much? Did you listen enough to the other person? I mean, sometimes what we want to say or what we feel we need to say, we're so excited about it that we talk. And so we have to remind ourselves, let's get a chance, or let's give the other person a chance to speak. That way we can learn their reaction. It's especially important for me because I can't see facial expressions.
Mm.
So if I'm with you face to face, I don't know how you're receiving or reacting to what I'm saying unless I stop and let you talk.
Yeah, yeah. So it's probably important. It's probably a good point to actually use pauses in our speech as well and have that breath to allow the other person that chance if they wanted to talk, even though if you're very passionate about your topic, to give them that chance to have some sort of input if they wished. Because sometimes it's a case where, you know, I'm sort of a person that don't mind being around people that just love talking because I love to listen and just observe, you know, how their mind works and how their thoughts work. But and then there's other people that just like to talk. They can really talk and they can, you know, just not stop talking. So I guess it depends on who you're around as well.
I have a few friends or acquaintances, depending on how you want to label the relationship, who fail to pause. You pointed out something very important, and that is at least pause and take a breath and see if the other person wants to insert something. And there's a few people I know who don't do that.
Yeah, they can just keep going. Very good. Okay, so what? On that actually, because in a situation where you're talking to someone face to face, you don't have that body language that a lot of us read. Now, there's science out there, or there's studies out there that say that, what is it, 55% is our verbal communication, the rest is body language. What's your sense of that? I mean, have you just developed better skills as far as listening and taking in messages of tone to, you know, understand exactly how they're feeling? Without the body language there, is there a lot missing from your life, or has it just become something you're used to through practice?
Let me say something that's interesting. People who have hearing loss often don't know that they have a hearing loss until they find out what they missed. And if nobody tells them what they missed, they don't realize they have a hearing loss. Mm. It's the same thing with me with regard to facial expressions. For much of my life, I didn't know what I was missing by not being able to see body language and facial expressions. Until very recently, I have a couple of friends who also serve as assistants to me, and they start talking to me about my facial expressions. In fact, both of them would say, okay, what's wrong? And I said, what makes you think something's wrong? And because in my head, there's nothing wrong unless I express something wrong, right? And yeah. They said, I'm looking at your face. I can see something is wrong. So it is only in the past year or year and a half so that I realized that maybe I'm missing a whole lot by not being able to see facial expressions or body language. I'm not sad about that. I'm perfectly happy with what I've been able to glean up to now. So I'm not bemoaning the fact that I can't see the body language. I think it's important that the other person realize they're going to have to express verbally if they want me to know about it.
Yeah, right. Okay. Wow. Amazing stuff. I've got a lot of questions I could ask around this topic, but I don't want to miss out on some of the juicy stuff as well. What, just going through that in your life, now you said from a young age you sort of were encountered with this condition, so, you know, perhaps it wasn't as hard to handle as maybe later in life, but certainly you still had sight up until 16, 24 through one eye. How do you go forward and you know, not let it defeat you in life? Because a lot of people that don't have even that sort of an issue in their life, they just have minor issues compared to that, just feel defeated and they just give up and they lose hope and they don't go forward with any sort of purpose or meaning in their life. How do you, you know, keep pushing forward? Or, well, how did you keep pushing forward initially?
I think it has to do with individuals and not the loss of a particular function. Because I went to school with other students or contemporaries who were blind, and what they accomplish in their life vary greatly. I would say of the people that I went to school, if you lined them up, if you looked at what they achieved, some might say, well, Dana achieved more than everybody else. Dana went to Yale and he became a judge, et cetera, et cetera. But there are some of my contemporaries who never got a job at all. They simply stayed at home and received program funding through the government, aid to the blind, or supplemental security income is what it became later. So I think it's individual. I don't think it's the condition itself. Several years ago, within a short span of time, I talked to two ladies who told me about their fathers who became blind and late in life. One of them, she said her father just sat down in the house and gave up life. I mean, he did nothing after losing his sight. The other, she said her father became blind when she was a young girl, a young child, and she didn't know that he had become blind.
Oh, yeah.
until she was older and understood what blindness was about. She said that he did everything that he always did. The only thing he didn't do around the house was he didn't leave and go to work in the morning. But other than that, around the house, he did things like even repairing electricity, electrical problem. So it has to do with what's inside the person that causes them to drive. For me, number one, I am stubborn. My mother used to tell me all the time, "You're such a stubborn person." And because I was stubborn, I should say that also when I was young, I heard many, many people say, "He's blind, he can't."
Yeah, and you would have.
Because I was stubborn, I decided I wanted to prove them wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. Only I can determine what I can do or not do. So every time somebody said he's blind, he can't, I would set out to prove them wrong. So I think I accomplished what I accomplished in my life. I adjusted to the blindness, and I proceeded in proving people wrong. So I did a lot of things that, you know, the first blind guy to do this, the first blind guy to do that, because I wanted to show others it can be done. Our eyesight is just one of five senses that we're given to perceive the world. That's only 20% that you lose when you lose. I mean, in terms of your sensory facilities, you've only lost 20%. There's 80% left. And you use that other 80% to its maximum, and you can still enjoy the world.
Do you find your other senses elevate because of the loss of one?
I don't know if I could claim it as elevating or becoming keener. I can only say I learned to use them more than maybe a person with sight would use them.
Well, I guess maybe through that practice, then that would obviously improve them to a higher extent as well, because we know that practice certainly does that.
Yes.
So interesting. Okay, now that's very interesting. You know, about the individual drive or the individual person that actually will determine, I guess, then the direction of life. But as a motivational speaker, I mean, is it possible then to inspire and motivate people that perhaps don't have that drive? Because, you know, I've probably got a lot of listeners out there that are the entrepreneurial type, certainly a lot of people that have got their own personal drive. But there's probably a lot of people out there that have this drive, they have this big dream, they want to, you know, do all these great things in life, but they're just not getting started, you know. They're still watching TV at night, or they're still doing stuff that's perhaps not conducive to reaching their goals. As a motivational speaker, as someone who inspires people, how do you overcome that obstacle if it's all individual basis then?
What I tell people all the time, even though I call myself a motivational speaker, I cannot motivate you. You have to motivate yourself. What I can do is help you find the compelling reason to act.
Right.
We tend to have an inclination for comfort and not pursue the hard thing, unless we have a compelling reason to do so.
Yeah.
And what compels people varies from person to person. For example, as a motivational speaker, a professional speaker who wants to go out and speak, I am not motivated as much by money. I like to get paid, yes. But why do I do what I do? I do what I do because I believe that I have a message inside of me that can help somebody else. And while there may be another professional speaker that says, you know, I got into this business because I saw how I can make money. And so it's money that drives them. Everybody has their drive. Well, for me, as a speaker, then my job is to help you find that compelling reason to act. As a part of that, I'm going to inspire because of what I accomplished, but I'm also going to try to lay out an explanation in a clear, entertaining way so that you can follow it. You can say, okay, that's what he says I need to do. I'm going to try that.
So, yeah, again, it's some techniques and tricks, I get, not tricks, but techniques, certainly, that you might be able to use to help you then discover that compelling reason.
Correct. So you give them some guidelines. For example, you know, we can talk about purpose. You know how often it is people will look at something that someone else is doing and say, ooh, I want to do that. And they may want to do that because it's glamorous. They may want to do that because it brings fame. They may want to do that because it brings lots of money. But you've got to find out, were you given the talents and skills to do that? Is that your assignment to the universe? In order for this universe to function, we need all kinds of services. We need people to do all kinds of things. And just because Stevie Wonder might be a great singer, is making a lot of money and has a lot of fame as a result of it, there's no reason for Dana to pursue that because he happens to have a couple of characteristics similar to Stevie Wonder. I happen not to have a talent for professional singing.
Oh, I reckon you could probably bust out a good tune.
No, don't test me on that one, okay?
Oh, you might have to now. Sorry. So, yeah, in that sense then, do we have innate talents and skills then that we should be trying to connect with? Because, I mean, every kid at school probably wants to be a rock star or an actress because it's glamour, it's glitz, it's fame, it's money. You know, but and a lot of kids still follow that dream. They go through life for many, many years following it. But does that mean we can't learn certain talents and tricks and skill?
There are skills that you can learn. And obviously, the degree at which you perform it, or the proficiency or the excellency in which you perform it, will vary depending on the physical characteristics of your makeup, right? Yeah. You can learn the technical stuff about music, but if your vocal cords weren't designed in a certain way, you're not going to be able to produce music like someone else might be able to do it. And it's the same with speaking. I mean, a lot of people point out, and in fact, I have to tell you, I was speaking in Indonesia, it was, a couple of years ago, and during a Q&A, someone asked, how do you get your voice to sound that way? Well, I do nothing special for my voice. It's what I was given. But I didn't have a good answer for them, and of course, sometimes I like to be all the time I like to be humorous. So I said, I've got to develop a humorous response to that. So the next time someone asks me, I'll have an answer. And sure enough, the following week I was in Taiwan during a Q&A session. Someone said, how do you get your voice to sound that way? I said, every morning I drink voice juice. And they thought I was serious. They wanted to know where they can get it. You know, no, I don't do anything special for my voice. Once I know that my voice is valuable to what I want to do as a public speaker, I make sure I don't do things to ruin the voice. So you don't find me out on a sports field cheering for a particular team. I'm not going to ruin my voice that way.
Yeah, right. Okay.
The answer is yes. We were born with abilities. We were born with talents that in how we judge them in their proficiency or the excellence in which we perform them will vary from person to person. But there are also things that we were not born to do. I have a son who's a professional dancer. Yep. He dances, he does ballet, and he's quite good at it. His mother used to say it all the time, and I considered her to be biased So I didn't pay attention to her. But when he got his first professional job and there was a review of his dancing in the newspaper, I said, oh, that's not his mother speaking. So I guess he really is a good dancer. I can guarantee you he did not get that from me. So he has something I don't have. Hmm. Now, he has a nice voice, too. He has a nice speaking voice. He has a nice singing voice. But he doesn't seek to be a professional speaker as I am. He wants to pursue his dancing. So the point here is you might even have the ability to do something quite well, say dancing, but choose to do something else because you also have the ability to do that something else. That's what I like about purpose for us as humans. We have a choice about what we do, what contribution we make to the universe.
Hmm.
In my speeches, I talk about how other creations of our universe may not have a choice. I use apple tree for an example. So the apple tree, from the time it starts generating, it pushes up toward the purpose of producing apples, and that's all it's ever going to do. It can't make the decision, I'm tired of doing apples, I'm going to do bananas today. but we as humans do have that choice.
Yeah.
Our purpose can be one thing from age 20 to 30, from 30 to 40, from 40 to 50. Our purposes can change, or we can have multiple purposes at the same period of time. That's the beauty of life and our opportunity to find meaning in life.
Yeah, it's a very privileged choice and something that we should really connect with and be grateful for, probably on a regular basis, really. As far as that, you know, that choice, as you said, it's a beautiful way to look at it. An apple tree doesn't have that choice. With the choice of purpose, as you just said, then you could actually change it. So I like to sort of look at purpose as, you know, discovering your why. What's your purpose? What's the reason you're here? But you've actually read a fantastic book called Making the Moment Meaningful, with the subtitle Creating a Path of Purpose and Fulfillment. So you've probably got a little bit more knowledge on this topic than I do. How do we go about then connecting with our purpose and finding it? Because I tend to agree that we all have talents and skills, and sometimes I believe that we could follow a certain path that maybe doesn't line up with our talents and skills, but it's just going to be a long and painful path because it's really not fitting with what we our true purpose is, I guess. So I think it's really important to experiment and try different things to really find that purpose. But what's your take on that? First of all, how do we connect with our purpose?
I think you hit it, and that is experiment. Try different things. As I mentioned earlier, I got my degree in math from Yale. But in my senior year, I decided the path that math would take me is not the path I wanted to go. So then I went to law school.
Hmm.
And I was a short time in law school when I realized I don't like law. I certainly didn't like law school. What I discovered that I liked was the opportunity to be the person making the decision. So listen to two different arguments and resolve it for them. So my head always worked toward being a judge. And I did eventually come to that position.
Hmm.
I worked there for 29 years. And yeah, I said, I've done a judge for 29 years. I need to do something else. I want to do something else. The judging was fun. I didn't leave the job because it wasn't fun. I enjoyed it. I appreciated the money that I made in doing so. But then the passion was about public speaking. And that's why I retired, so that I could do that. So I think it's a matter of experimenting new things, being willing to, as I say in many of my speeches, say yes to the possibilities. You might discover, after you say yes to the possibilities, this is not what I want. So you make the transition out of it. I don't believe in starting and quitting and starting and quitting. I think you have to accomplish. You have to have a string of successes. So, for example, I didn't stop law school, even though I didn't like law school. I finished it. So as far as discovering your purpose is, figure out what your talents are. So try different things to see, go try out some line dancing and see how it turns out. Yeah. Or join a Toastmasters club and see what public speaking is about. Or volunteer at a hospital and see what the medical profession might be about. There are different things you could do to figure out what do I do well. And you'll find that out as you do things. You'll discover what I do well. So you want to find out what you do well. But you also want to do what makes me feel good when I do it. I believe that's one of our innate guidelines or gauges for determining whether we're living our purpose. Is it satisfying to the soul?
Yeah, so this is along the lines of connecting with, something that you're passionate about. And as you said, to, liking what you do.
Absolutely. What happens is we get distracted by so many things. We do get distracted by fame or class, position, money. So we get led down a path that may not be what the universe intended for us. And it's never too late, as long as you're still breathing, to say, you know what, this isn't it. I got to move on to something else. I hear it all the time. And the reason why I wrote the book is that I heard famous people on television. I had friends write personal letters in conversation. I hear people say, I'm trying to find meaning in my life. And as I contemplated those statements, I said, the problem here is that we shouldn't be searching for meaning, because we don't have any guidelines as to where do we go to search. Do you go to the top of the Himalayas to find meaning in your life? What you should do is make each moment of your life meaningful. So meaning is something that you make, not something for which you search. So in the book, I give some guidelines for determining whether what you do is leading to meaningfulness. And I give four guidelines. If it's leading to your growth, if it's connecting you with others and the universe, or another word is relationships.
Yeah.
Fulfilling your purpose, and if it's defining you the way you want to be defined, then it's going to be meaningful.
So growth, connecting you with others or the universe, fulfilling your purpose, and the final one was defining.
Yeah, self-definition.
Self-definition. Yeah, really good. Really good takeouts for the audience there. I'm just taking notes myself there, Dana. So I like the idea of, not trying to search and find that meaningful life, but rather than creating it in the moment. And sort of what I connected with there is just like, I sort of often think that it's living in each moment with greater passion and purpose. So doing in each moment things that you enjoy, things that, as you said before, connect with your soul, and things that are purposeful to you and your journey. Not for those other distractions, which you sort of alluded to as well. And I really like that as far as a takeaway for the audience, because often we get distracted basically due to society and how we've brought up, our education, etc. And we think it's the path that we have to go, rather than it's actually looking for the path that connects with us more deeply. And often we get, put off on tangents and walking down paths that, and certainly I'm familiar with it not so long ago, where I was definitely on a journey after school, after university, where I was going down a path that really wasn't in alignment with my path, my personal path. And that's only through personal transformation that I discovered that there was, you know, an actual path that I should be taking. And that's where I've led me to creating this podcast and the blog and, you know, sharing this information with other people, because I really believe that it's helping me define my path as well and helping me create a more meaningful life in the process of doing it. So, yeah, love what you just shared there. It certainly resonates with me quite deeply.
It does exactly what you described. I mean, for example, when I learned about your podcast, I said, oh, that's great. And the thought flashed in my head, maybe I should do a podcast. And I said, no, Dana, you like being on the stage. You like being live. You know, there's some people who the podcast is perfect for them because that's where they want to be. I want to be on the stage. I want to be, you know, face-to-face, person-to-person interaction. So while I think podcast is a great thing, I'm probably not going to do that. Maybe when I'm 90 and it's harder for me to get out, maybe I will do a podcast. Do that.
Be luck getting out then.
I do. Oh, yeah.
No, fantastic. And let's just go to that for a second. I really thank you for sharing that, first of all. And I will put the... I'll put all your books, because you've written 4 books, all inspiring and motivating, you know, people to take a more meaningful path in their life, I suppose. So I'll put all those links in the show notes for the audience listening. So, guys, you can jump on thehiddenwhy.com and you'll see the links there. And you can certainly pick them up from Dana's website, which is danalamon.com, danalamon.com. So they're all available there as well, plus a bunch of other stuff.
Thank you, Lee.
You're most welcome. So I wanted to ask you, your speech in Toastmasters, I've got a couple of other questions I want to ask you. We'll see how we go for time. But first of all, the speech that won you the title in 1992 was called Take a Chance. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So what's the essence of this speech? Because I have listened to it, and I'm not sure if it was the exact speech or whether it was a remake, I guess. But what's the essence of this speech? Because I liked the message. So can you share that with us?
Yeah, understand the setting for the contest was Las Vegas, Nevada. So as I was preparing my speech, I said, what will people's minds be on? And I said, probably gambling.
Winning.
Well, gambling and winning, right. And then I asked, why are we so willing to spend time at a machine to gain a monetary jackpot? Why aren't we as willing to invest in ourselves? As I asked that question, I came up with 3 things that may keep us from taking a chance on ourselves. And so I addressed those in the speech. Now, I understand it's only a 5 to 7 minute speech, so you can't go through a whole lot of detail.
No.
But I talked about how fear, comfort, and indifference stops us from taking a chance in ourselves.
Fear, comfort, and indifference.
Yes.
Okay. And why does that stop us? I mean, are they the 3 elements, I guess, that stop us? I get it, but just explain that a little bit further for us.
Fear stops us because what fear does, our response to fear is to run away from it. And in fact, I had a lady tell me that she heard me give a speech in 1994 at the Toastmaster convention. I saw her again the next year, and she said, I lived a life of fear. I think of things to do, and fear would stop me from doing it. The fear of failing, or the fear of what people will think about it. And she said, and then I wouldn't do it. So, but after you gave your speech, I hear it in my speech. I said, you can't win if you don't get in the race. And she said, I hear that every time fear comes up. I hear your voice say, you can't win if you don't get in the race. She says, and it's changed my life. I start doing things that I once feared. Comfort is a problem because we get, you know, people who are successful, they find comfort in their success. I was like that. By the time I had given that speech, I was working as a judge. I'd already bought a house. I had a wife. I had children. So all it was from that point was clear sailing to death. I guess, you know, I was comfortable with where I was.
Mm.
And when we get comfortable, then we don't continue to challenge ourselves. Comfort thwarts our growth.
Mm.
And then indifference. There's some people who say, I don't, it doesn't matter to me. I don't care. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. And it's that indifference. And maybe that indifference is caused by, in my expanded version, I use Ray Charles's song, Born to Lose. There's so many people who feel that they were born to lose. So they become indifferent about trying new things or taking a chance on themselves because their thought is, you're not going to win anyway. I've heard people say that with regard to the machines at Las Vegas. They said, you know, the chances of your winning, quite small.
Yeah.
I said, it absolutely is. But it's larger than the chance of my winning if I don't play at all.
If you don't play at all. Yeah, so you got to be in it. You got to be in it to win it.
That's right. That's right.
I think the indifference, too, sometimes I wonder if it's not. It's more just the unknown. They don't really know what perhaps they could be doing or what they could be missing out on. And maybe that's why they're just quite, maybe that links to comfort more than indifference. But, yeah.
No, I think you do point out a difference. Comfort is taking what you know and being satisfied. Indifference, you can have people who are indifferent, who are, they're not satisfied with where they are, but they're indifferent about taking a chance in finding something else because they don't know. You're right. They may not know. I didn't know about professional speaking until I was 36 years old. I mean, I knew about public speaking. I knew that people spoke, but I didn't know it could be something for which you could be paid until I was 36 years old.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, so yes, it's even the job that I had for 29 years, I didn't know the job existed. I didn't learn about that job when I was in law school. I learned about it just happened to being in a different job and having a bulletin crossed my desk, and I said, oh, this is something new. This sounds like something I should look at.
Okay. So that's great, yeah. Isn't it? Like when your ears pick up at something, you prick up at something, and you sort of get that inkling or intuition, that sense that just it feels like it could be something that you might be interested in. And if you just go for it and put yourself in it, that's the only way you're really going to find out, because if you don't, you just never will know. And I think my greatest fear in life is dying with any form of regret. So that's sort of what I live with now, is just trying to wake up and not have that, you know.
Now, it's interesting because you said you label it as fear, and that's one kind of fear that becomes your motivator, right? Because you fear dying with some kind of regret, you are willing to try some things to find purpose so that doesn't happen.
But you know, I wonder too, but because sometimes, you know, on the whole, and you mentioned this before, you know, the whole on the path of experimentation to searching for your purpose, for your why, that we can often stop and start. And you said, you know, you certainly weren't one of those people that stopped and started. And, you know, 29 years in a career is a very good innings. In this, you know, for younger people, myself, I've never really had a career for longer than 3 or 4 years, I guess, might be the max, perhaps even five. So, you know, I've certainly juggled and tossed between careers, and I think the younger generation seem to do that more and more often, and maybe that's a reason for, you know, that satisfaction, no, instant gratification, I can't even say that word, satisfaction. You know, what's the difference there?
Actually, I think that's a great thing, Lee. You see, I come from an era, I was born in the 50s, and that was still at the time, in fact, early, I was born in 52.
Yeah.
So that's a time when people just, they got a job. And the key thing was staying on the job for 30 years, staying long enough to get a gold watch or whatever. But our economy has changed. There was a time, for example, I remember reading about IBM and the founding of IBM, their dedication to their employees. They keep their employees because there was a dedication to the family, to the employees, to the community. We're now in an economy where the dedication is to the bottom line profit. So if we have to lay off 10,000 people, we're going to do that. We don't. And so our economy has helped to develop the younger generation that says, I'm not thinking of being there for 30 years. I have to tell you a funny story if I have the time. Yeah. When I was interviewed for my job as a judge, the guy asked me, he says, how long do you think you will stay with us? And I said, well, let's see. I mean, I believe in being honest, you know, in interviews. I will tell you exactly what I'm thinking. So I said, well, let's see. I was 3 years in junior high school, 3 years in high school, 4 years at Yale, 3 years at law school. I was 3 years at my last job. I said, it looks like I'm going to give you a good 3 or 4 years and then I'll move on. So, and he hired me.
Oh, yeah.
So the point here is that I think it's perfectly acceptable to say I'm going to do this for 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. I don't think we're going to find the people who the young people who can say I was doing this for 29 years, unless it was establishing their own business for which they were passionate.
Mm.
Then they might be there for 29 years, but working for someone else. Oh, I don't expect they're going to be around that long.
It's certainly changing, isn't it?
And I think it's a good idea. I think it's good to experiment and, you know, you can make widget one for 10 years and decide, you know what, I think I'm going to go move over to making widget two. And you know what might happen by that experience? You say, okay, I know something about widget one. I know something about widget two. And now I've got a new idea. I can see how we can combine widget one and widget two and create a new product. And then you become an innovator, an inventor. And that's what the universe needs. People who do that as well.
Yeah, I coined that term called passion sex. That's where you get one of your passions and couple it with another one and create something new.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Passion sex.
No, very interesting stuff. I'm interested in that whole, you know, stopping and starting and what it means. And I've got this self-awareness about it, but I think it's really important to keep doing that, keep searching. And if you're really not connecting with someone, don't be so fearful of making that change. And I read a great article by you recently called Change Advice, ADVICE. So certainly would like to direct the audience to go and have a read of that. I think it's on your website, isn't it?
No, actually, I think you can read it on Toastmasters' website.
I'll find the link and stick it in the notes anyway.
There is an excerpt of a speech that I did, Change Advice, that's on the website.
Maybe, okay. Yeah. So, you know, I'll put that there. But certainly I believe that it's necessary to go through those changes and find something that you really like and connect with. But I also think there's a point where you have to just question whether it's you're doing it just because you're giving up, it's too challenging, and you've come up against a hurdle, or if you're actually doing it because it's not really fitting with you. And someone recently said to me about, you know, transferring a new plant, a seedling. You know, if you keep moving that seedling from one spot to the other, it's going to really struggle to grow and develop. So there's some truth to just, you know, being planted in a spot for a bit more time just to allow you to really grow and develop that certain area of skill.
And I think it depends on what it is that you're doing, right? Mm. I've got pine trees out in front of my front yard. They are taller than the two-story house that I'm in.
Yeah.
I can't transplant those. Those are there. I have to let them grow and let them do whatever they're going to do. I think it's important to point out when I talked about stop and start, what I was saying is you don't quit in the middle of something.
Yeah.
So if you start law school, you finish law school. You don't say, oh, this isn't for me. Go ahead and finish it and then make your determination. Because stopping and starting in the middle of something before you complete something is harmful to your self-esteem, but it's also harmful to your resume if that's what you're going to need later on.
Right. Okay. Good point. Good point. Look, I want to ask you a few more questions before we wrap this up. And certainly, Dana, as I said before we started the interview, I just had a feeling that we could talk and talk and talk. And I really feel like we could probably talk for another hour or two right now, but we won't do that today. I'd love to get you back on the show potentially one day. Yeah. So hopefully,
yeah, that's what I was going to say. We could do that, but just not all in one day.
No, break it up a bit.
Yeah.
No, look, it's been fantastic to chat. I've got a bunch of questions that I ask all guests that come on my show, so I'm going to just ask you those questions, and then we'll probably wrap it up within the next 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
If that's okay. So first question I just want to ask you is, do you have any particular routines or rituals that you do daily that you attribute to your success?
I don't have any routines that I do daily. There are things that I do. One of the things that I do, I have an I am statement, and it's basically a list of things that I use to define myself. And not daily, but frequently in the evening, I go through the events of the day to determine if what I did was consistent with who I am or how I want to define myself.
Okay, fantastic. So sort of a personal statement.
And I suppose one other rule that helps me in my success is I respond. When people contact me, I respond as quickly as I can. Very often, people, when I respond to their email, their response back to me was, oh, thank you for getting back to me so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I'm stunned by that. I'm thinking, well, everybody should respond that quickly. I mean, that shouldn't be a surprise. Yeah. But I do respond to people's requests quickly.
Quickly. Okay, very good point. What advice, if you could go back in time to your 20-year-old self, is there any advice you'd give yourself, or was there any advice you'd give the 20-year-olds that are listening out there?
You know, I speak about something that was said to me, or a poem that was quoted to me by a neighbor when I was 14 years old. And I don't know who the author is, but I've heard other people quote it. Says if a job is once begun, leave it not until it's done. Be the task great or small, do it well or not at all. That is probably the foundational advice that I've given myself, and I would share with anyone. Do it well or not at all.
Yes, and don't do it half-fast.
Yes, exactly.
That's one bit of advice I got on the beginning to my personal transformational journey. A mentor of mine that I really look up to, and he said, you know, just go into everything. Everything you do, just give it your 110%. You know, go above and beyond. And I always remember him just talking about an example. At a dinner party, you know, you're at a friend's house. A lot of people won't stand up to wash the dishes, you know, at someone else's house. He sort of used that as the example. Go up there and just, you know, give that little bit extra. Always give that extra. Do it as better than anyone else might have been expecting.
Right.
So I think that relates to that as well. So, yeah, I like that advice. Next question is, what is your meaning of success?
Success is being in a position where you can love and experience joy. That's what it is for me.
Fantastic. And I got some quick round questions. What's your favorite food?
Hamburger.
Hamburger, nice. Don't mind a good hamburger. And have you got a favorite leisure activity?
I love doing puzzles, and it varies between doing word puzzles such as crosswords or number puzzles such as Sudoku or Kinkin.
Kinkin.
Yes. It's a variation on Sudoku, and it was started by a guy in Japan, but you can find them at kinkin.com.
Kinkin.com. I'll have to look that up. I don't mind the old Sudoku.
That's kinkin.com.
That's, I haven't heard that one. Well, at least I don't think I have.
I, w- I once did a speech in Toastmasters. It was nothing in the room but ladies. I said, if you offer me sex or offer me a puzzle, I'll take the puzzle every time.
So, have you got a favorite book other than The Four of Your Own that you'd like to recommend for the audience?
I'm glad that you said other than my own. You know, believe it or not, I got a lot as to the stuff that I'm talking about in the meaningfulness of life. I don't know if I could say a favorite book, just one. I've read a lot, but I really enjoyed Memoir of a Geisha. There were so many statements that the author made about the meaningfulness of life.
I read that probably around 10 years ago now. So it rings a bell, yeah. Okay, cool. I'll stick that in the show notes, guys. So jump on thehiddenwhite.com. You can get that book through the links there, plus all of Dana's books there as well. And if you're not a member of Audible, we've got a deal. You can get 2 free audiobooks with them at this stage. So if you just go to thehiddenwhite.com, you'll see the link there as well. Now, Dana, have you got a favorite quote?
You know, my favorite, I end up with favorites that probably the poem that I gave you would be one. The rest of the favorites happen to be my own because those are the ones that's easiest for me to remember.
Yeah.
And one of them is, love is the unselfish interest in the well-being of another.
Love is the unselfish interest in the well-being of another.
Yes.
By yourself.
Yes. Fantastic. I don't know it. I don't know where it is in any of my materials, but it's in lots of my speeches.
It's there. Fantastic. Okay, last question for you, and we've probably covered this in some level of detail already, but just to summarize it, what does living life with passion and purpose mean to you?
It means making the contribution to the universe that you were intended to make. And for me specifically, it's about living and speaking in a way that inspires others to give and to serve.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Dana, I just want to thank you. You've shared so much tonight, and there's so many more questions I want to ask you. I certainly want to ask you about, you know, giving presentations, speaking, and there was a bunch of other material that I was interested in of yours that I've read online there as well. So I'd love to get you back on the show one day, but for tonight, thank you. And how did the audience reach you? You've got your website there, danalamon.com.
.com, and they can write to me specifically, dana@danalamon.com.
Dana, and I'm sure that's on the website as well if they're struggling to find it, but I'll put that in the show notes as well so they can email you. Thank Dana for coming on the show, guys. If you're listening in, I hope you've enjoyed this one. I certainly have. I've loved it every moment. So reach out to him. Thank him for coming on the show. And if you've got any questions, I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. So appreciate that, Dana.
Lee, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. We'll keep in touch and we'll get you back on the show at some stage. So thanks again. And guys, thanks for listening. Jump onto thehiddenwhite.com. Check out all the show notes there. My key takeouts from this conversation as well, as always, plus the book links and other bits and pieces, all at thehiddenwhite.com. Until next time, guys, peace, passion, and purpose. We'll see you soon. There you have it, gang. That's today's episode done. What did you think? Did you enjoy it? Did it bring you some value? I'd love to hear from you. Make sure you jump onto thehiddenwhite.com to this episode and leave your comments in the fields below. Also, connect with me, guys, while you're there. Facebook, Twitter, and my email address, thehiddenwhiteguy@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you guys. I'd love to hear about what you're passionate about, what brings you joy in life. So connect with me there, guys, any way you wish. Also, guys, I want to ask you, before you go, for a huge, huge, huge favor. And the favor is simple. It's just to go to thehiddenwhite.com and subscribe to my newsletter. And here's why.
I want to keep you up to date on a project that I've been working on. For the last year, I've been writing my newest book called The Ultimate Life Map. It's really about helping people align their lives with their purpose, with their why, so they can live more truly, freely, fulfilled, and happy. That's what it's all about. So if I can get into more hands, then I can help more people with that. But in doing so, the funds from this book, guys, I'm going to launch a project to help raise funds to support a third world community, to build skills there, to help these children that aren't as privileged as we are, that don't have all the resources that we have, so they can set themselves up and hopefully live towards a more promising life as well. So guys, I really want to ask for your help, and the best thing you can do for me right now is just to subscribe to my newsletter. Jump online, subscribe to the newsletter, and that way I can keep you up to date with what's going on, guys. You can help me really, you know, spread the message, get this book out there into more hands, and in doing so, we can raise funds to support this community. I've got a couple of options there now, so more information on that to come as well. But guys, that's my favorite from you today. Please just jump online, subscribe to my newsletter so I can keep you posted with this project. I'm really passionate about it, guys, and it'd be really great if you can support me with this. That's it from me, guys. You know what to do. You need to go out there, breathe more passion into every single moment. You need to do everything with greater purpose, and in doing so, you will discover your hidden why. This is Lee Manozzi. Thank you. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon.